Les conférences du Collège de France.
Je suis heureux d'accueillir pour sa première conférence notre collègue Touraj Dariahi, qui va donc nous indiquer sur l'affiche, va nous donner quatre conférences ce mois-ci autour de la notion d'Iran dans la culture sassanide. Alors, Touraj est, que je connais depuis longtemps, est professeur occupe la chaire, la Massive Chair. D'études iraniennes à l'université Irvine. Alors l'université d'Irvine est l'une des branches de l'université de Californie, d'autres branches étant Berkeley, Los Angeles et d'autres. Il a fait plusieurs séjours chez nous, dont en 2010 invité par l'École des hautes études en sciences sociales et puis je crois une autre occasion peut-être par le PHE. Donc, ses recherches tournent depuis longtemps sur l'histoire de l'Iran sassanide. Il est l'un des acteurs du renouvellement historiographique sur cette période qui a donc été la dernière grande période impériale de l'Iran pré-islamique. Il a publié il y a quelques années et remis à jour très récemment ce livre que je recommande, qui est une synthèse bien informée des travaux récents, et notamment des travaux récents iraniens, parfois parus seulement en persan, qui évidemment circulent très, très mal chez nous. Je dirais, pour caractériser sa recherche, que bien sûr, il reprend les thèmes habituels de l'historiographie, c'est-à-dire l'histoire militaire, la construction de l'État, l'histoire des règnes, etc., la structure administrative, mais avec un intérêt particulier pour dans plusieurs directions. L'une des caractéristiques de sa recherche, c'est qu'il revient toujours aux documents dits primaires. C'est une réorientation historiographique qui s'est fait jour chez nous aussi à partir des années 70 avec Philippe Gignoux et Erika Gizelen. Pendant longtemps, jusqu'à la grande synthèse restée très fondamentale d'Arthur Christensen, l'Iran sous les Sassanides, deuxième édition en 1944, je crois, on s'appuyait beaucoup pour reconstruire l'histoire sassanide sur des témoignages postérieurs, des témoignages de la tradition arabo-persane. Et on tend maintenant, sans négliger ces témoignages quand ils restent irremplaçables, on tend maintenant à donner le pas aux sources émanant directement de cette société et sources contemporaines. Donc les inscriptions, les grandes inscriptions royales qui ont été, dont l'étude se continue parce que on n'en trouve pas d'autres, mais on trouve des morceaux. On trouve encore des morceaux d'une des principales, celle de Paikouli, et puis tout un matériel qui était assez négligé avant, qui était le matériel des sceaux administratifs, qui en fait est une source tout à fait irremplaçable pour accéder directement à la pratique administrative de l'État. Et puis une autre particularité de la recherche de Touraj, qui est assez spécifique, c'est un grand intérêt pour les manifestations de la vie quotidienne, des sensibilités de la vie quotidienne, etc. Il a fait un nombre assez considérable d'articles sur le vin, le miel, toutes sortes de produits alimentaires et également ce qu'on appelait chez nous les manières de table, en rééditant notamment un court traité sassanide qui leur est consacré. Et là, il rejoint, il a également travaillé beaucoup, enfin, ces temps derniers surtout, sur les parfums, l'olfaction, l'importance de l'olfaction dans cette société. Eh bien, ça rejoint tout à fait des tendances qui sont celles maintenant de l'histoire du Moyen-Âge occidental. Ces données sont, ces données de la vie quotidienne sont de plus en plus prises en compte, et notamment par l'école historique française. Donc, sans plus tarder, je lui passe la parole pour la première conférence, The Idea of Iran in Late Antiquity. Donc, Touraj présentera ses conférences en anglais. Et puis, comme ça a été le cas pour le séminaire il y a deux jours, dans la discussion qui suivra, les gens pourront prendre la parole, soit en anglais, soit en français.
Professor Grenet, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and pleasure to be here with you at this very important institution on the invitation of Professor Grenet, but really the kindness of a number of people who have helped in me coming here. Of course, foremost is Collège de France and Professor Grenet, which I thank. My former student, Dr. Nina Majdjou, who is now here. Delphine, who just walked out, Pinsu, who has been very kind. And it's really great to see some of the familiar scholars that I have read about, Professor de Lavoisier, Professor Azarnouch, and those who are here amongst you. In four lectures, I am going to discuss the idea of Iran in its earliest phases to late antiquity. My interest is this antique tardif, or this late antiquity, and then maybe move a little bit forward and back to try to gauge what does this mean in the wider context of Iranian history. I would like to dedicate this talk, and I'll do one for each, to a colleague of mine who taught me much, Iraj Afshar, who was a great man who traversed Iran probably more than anyone, and took me for more than a decade to really figure out where this place is, rather than sitting in the center that is the capital and imagining what the idea of Iran is, or Iranians, but rather traveling to villages and towns and staying at people's home and eating their food and thinking about what they thought about who they are and their local histories. Having said that, let me begin. At some time in history of a people living in Southwest Asia, they began to call themselves Iranians, and the political boundary which they overtook as Iran. To understand what this means, one needs to go further than simply discuss the etymology of terms as it appears in ancient documents and writings. That is, what did it mean to be an Iranian, and whether and or when such a conception with a set of mores and values existed beyond the issue of simple ethnos. Yes, it works. As is already known, and I apologize if I am repeating already the well-discussed material here, in the Indo-Iranian tradition of the recorded Vedic and Avestan world, an ethnic epithet was mentioned where, I'm talking about the Aryas, whose dwelling is recorded, this Aryanam Dahyunam, where according to Videvdat, the important section of the Avesta, chapter 1.1, is called Aryanam Vaja, the Aryan Rapids, where the red dragon exists and a long winter of 10 months, and that's why it has become uninhabitable, which is to be located is a debate, but Central Asia for some, such as Khwarazmia, Marv, Herat, Gershevich, and that's what Gershevich suggests, by the place called Vanghuva Daiti, the Aryan expanse of the Good Daiti, perhaps Amu Darya, the Oxus. And because of Angramainu, the evil spirit's assault in this, where these Aryans lived, or Iranians, it had become uninhabitable. Professor Grenet identifies Aryana Vaja with central Afghanistan, if I'm not mistaken, to some extent. This suggestion, against Michael Witzel, a great colleague of mine who has retired from Harvard, professor of Sanskrit, Helmut Humbach, the great scholar of Avesta, and Vogelsang, is important. They have had other ideas. And I really follow what Professor Grenet has said, not merely because I'm the guest of Professor Grenet here, but that it works with my hypothesis of the idea of Iran and its connection with what we call today modern Afghanistan. In the Yashts, Yasht 10, dedicated to the deity Mithra, the Mehr Yasht, 1013, Mithra surveys the lands, including what is called Aryo Shayonam, the Aryan abode. These Aryas are endowed, as you see there, with Khwarna, their own glory, with the secondary meaning of probably good fortune, giving to us Middle Persian Farrukhi. And the etymology of, I'm not a philologist, and I cannot say very much about it, but I can, of course, suggest that I think Al-Mutinsa's suggestion that this verbal root khwar from Indo-European swell, meaning to burn, to glow, seems to be quite attractive, and I think has the most attraction. But of course, there are other scholars, such as Professor Lubotsky, who has suggested to look at an Indo-Iranian Parnas, which is borrowed from Scythian, with the substitution of the initial fa by hua, which gives us Scythian farna, and Sanskrit parinas, abundance. But I think all in all, this first suggestion, as also Professor Kellens a long time ago in his Le Texte Via Lavistique, volume 2, page 236, had suggested that it is connections to the sun, smolder, burning. The Aryans have their other possessions and attributes, which on the Iranian side makes them distinct, I think, from their Indian counterpart. Most notably is the manly Erakhsha, what in Persian we have Arash, who is described in the Tishtar Yasht, the Yasht dedicated to the waters and the celestial, as having the most vibrating arrows of the Aryas. But to really put a wedge between our Iranian Aryas and those of the Indians, one has to read the recent, well, recent meaning anything in a decade for me is recent or two, obviously, of Professor Kellens's important article that we will discuss a little bit further, Les Aryas ne sont plus d'Aryas, ce sont déjà d'Iraniens. The Aryas are no longer Aryans, they are already Iranians, where he has attempted to show that the Arya in the Avesta has already taken the meaning of Iranian. The Arya of the Indians we shall categorize differently. And we will see this later on. These Iranians, or the nation of Iranians, as Kellens has stated, have rulers, of course, that we know in the Yash, such as Kawi Khosrowa, Ke Khosro, who are endowed with some sort of power, Kshatra. And this is a dynastic line that is created, whether historical or not is not my concern here, along with other personages in this Avesta, which will form ultimately the national tradition or history of the Iranians in late antiquity. And we'll discuss that in the fourth lecture. If so, as Professor Kellens suggests, then how are we to interpret this passage from Herodotus about the Medes, and not that is so, we're talking about 8th to 7th century BCE, where in Herodotus, book 7, it is stated the Medes were formerly called by everyone Arians, but when the Colchians, woman, Medea, came from Athens to Arians, they changed their name like the Persians. This is the Medes' own account of themselves. So that is one citation. The second one comes from Pausanias. The idea that Medes called themselves collectively as Arians also finds resonance in this passage. On the occasion referred to, Medea went to Athens and married Aegeus, but subsequently she was detected plotting against Thasus and fled from Athens. Also, coming to the land then called Aria, she caused its inhabitants to be named after her, Medes. While I think this is certainly an interpretatio Graecae of what Elias Bickerman has called origine gentum, this entanglement, as Pietro Vanicelli has succinctly stated more recently, begins with the time of the collaboration of the Greek city-states with the Tispid Achaemenid Persian Empire and the charges of Medism, that is, the Greek city-states who sided with the Persians against the Greek brethren. Still, we may gain some truth in the mention of the Medes as Arias, that is, as Iranians. If we again keep reminding ourselves of Kellens' important suggestions that the Iranians in the Iranian world mean, in fact, Iranian to some extent, has already developed, then the entire context of Achaemenid ethnic designation in old Persian inscriptions will have, I think, a new result. For example, Darius the Great's tomb inscription provides a window into this Persian understanding of ethnos, and I have tried to put the French at least to come some steps in this great location, so you could read the old Persian. Adam Dariavush, Chayayti, Avazar, Chayayti, Chayayti, and it goes, and there the French, which I will massacre it, but I will try it here. Je suis Darius, le grand roi, le roi de rois, le roi de pupelle de toute origine, le roi sous cette terre grande à loin, le fils de Vistas, Achaemenid, Perse, fils de Perse, Arian, de descendants Arian. That is the translation provided by Pierre Lecoq in his translation of Old Persian. Which the last line, if we take Kellens's suggestion that here Arian should be Iranian, where we would read a Persian, son of a Persian, the last one, Iranian, from an Iranian race or tradition. And I just, since I traversed the French, let me traverse the Persian as well. Man Dariush hastam, shah bozorg, shah shahan, shah mardoman az tamam tabarha. شاه روی این زمین بزرگ تا دور دست پسر ویشتسپه هخامنشی پارسی پسر پارسی ایرانی از تبار ایرانی. Let me bring together some other facts which may persuade us of such a conception of Iranian, what Ilya Gershevich once called pan-Iranian tradition. In reading the old Persian inscriptions, one comes to a curious passage in the Darius Behistun inscription, which you see a photo of, at least the part of the inscription and the scene, which deals with the Scythian, these are Eastern Iranian people, who we have already mentioned, who are punished for a very specific reason. And as you read, Tati Dariavushka Shayaitia of Avi Saka Arika Ahauta Nai Ahura Mazdasham. So, Darius says these Sakas were traitors because they did not worship Ahura Mazda. It was Richard Fry who pointed out that why should the Sakas be singled out as traitors? Not because they rose up against the Darius and his rule, as all of them did, and here's one Scythian, but these are Scythian called Saka Tigahudra, with the pointed hats, but why should these Sakas be pointed out for not worshiping Ahura Mazda? What kind of a crime would that entail against those others who rose up and were rebels, basically, in 520 to 521 BCE? He did not worship the Zoroastrian god, the what newly called the super deity of the Zoroastrian tradition, Ahura Mazda. This seems to be the crime. Again, we may find the answer to this oddity in the trilingual inscription of Darius's Behistun inscription, where Ahura Mazda is translated with a gloss in Elamite, which is well known, which states, rather than Old Persian Ahura Mazda, in Elamite we read Ahura Mazda, god of the Aryas. So already there's a distinction here that these Iranians have a very specific deity that is associated with them, because obviously in India the Aryas didn't do so, did not worship Ahura Mazda. Thus the Iranians appear to have their very own god as well, although ruling over a multitude of people, what the Persian inscriptions call Vispadana, Vispadana, many people in this empire. But the Scythians did not worship Ahura Mazda, and that seems to be a crime. We also take note of Herodotus 478, speaking about our Scythians and royalty, where the name of the king may interest us. Skyles was one of the sons born to Aryapetes, king of Scythia. What we may be seeing here is, again, a sort of Hellenocentric story, which leads to the downfall of Skyles, but dealing with onomastics, names, it can be telling of the ethnic and ideological preoccupation of those whose name are chosen by their father and parents. For Aryapetes, the first part of the name of this Scythian king, of course, is Arya. And we can take it as Aryo or Iranian, if we are thinking now in this context that we've been discussing. The second part has been suggested to be taken as a Grecization of paita, Iranian paita, adornment, French ornament, from Proto-Iranian paita. However, more recently, a very interesting and very controversial book by Christopher Beckwith, who won several awards, and it's quite stimulating in its suggestions, is that Aryapetes represents a Scythian national foundation myth, which made the name be taken as Aryapita, father of the Aryas, or the Iranians. And if you want to know, the citation is 2023, page 138. Now, I would like to bring up another possibility for what I call this pan-Iranian connection based on the coinage, numismatic evidence. Achaemenid numismatics is a difficult area of research. I just saw that a new book has come out on Achaemenid numismatics, and the problem with Achaemenid numismatics is indeed that there is so many coinage type, not the imperial per se, but the satrapal ones on the west, and to just capture that and try to classify that is still an ongoing process. Now, with having these problems, I, who once as a young boy went to the American Numismatic Society to study for a term, it gave me some sense of how this could be used beyond just coinage type per se. And this is what I would suggest looking at this Achaemenid coinage. It is usually thought that the imperial coinage, that of the Daric, as you see, the gold, and the Daric sigloid, the silver, shows the archer king. And most people suggest that this is indeed the king type, while the satrapal coinage form a diverse repertoire. And I've only put two or three types. There are many more. It's staggering on the sort of the typology of these coins on the West satrapies. already you could see on Asia Minor, and this is for satraps of Lycia, Caria, Ionia, Cilicia, Tarsus, they all mint their own coinage with the obverse symbolizing the local polity, culture, and the reverse, the Persian sort of power behind it. So this sort of dual system that one may be looking here. All the way to Egypt with Sabakis and this very interesting copper coinage that is minted in Judea, which has the legend of Yehud. And we think that is also part of this tradition as well. But if Babylon minted the gold type of the standing kneeling king, why, like the Western satrapies which minted their own coins, there are no diversity in the coin types on the Iranian plateau? I hope I am showing you the consistency to some extent. There are a few other changes. There's a sitting king, there's standing king, but it's still quite uniform. And diversity, not on the Iranian plateau. And only the king's coins are available. Here I mean in places such as Persis, Susiana, Media, Parthia, Drangiana, Gedrosia, Arochasia, Aria, and Bactria. So the Iranian plateau and what we call East Iran or Central Asia. It is true that on the Indo-Afghan area, bullion transactions and silver ingots as the weight of standards were used. But coins with Daric types existed and circulated, however crude they were. Are we to think that no mints were needed for the Iranian plateau, this large area that I just mentioned to you, all of these provinces, unlike the Western satrapies? Or could there be another possibility? I would contend that the reason that we do not find any diversity on the coins found on the Iranian plateau and what we call East Iran is the acceptance of the standing or the kneeling king as it represents this Iranian world, the image of the Iranian king as a whole. Hence, there's no need for diversity of what we find west of the Euphrates River with so many imagery and ideologies that are present on the coinage. That, I think, makes a sense that from Euphrates to the east, we're looking at a different cultural sort of tradition, even minting practices and so on, versus west of the Euphrates. Now, since I mentioned the Euphrates, this conception of Euphrates as a natural boundary appears time and time again in Iranian history. It's no wonder then when Darius is negotiating with Alexander of Macedon after the Battle of Issus, and all the citations are from, of course, Pierre Briand, who in Arian, in Quintus Curtius Rufus, and Justin and Diodorus and so on, although there are discrepancies in the description of what is being negotiated or what Darius is trying to see to Alexander in return for his children, of course, and so on, what we actually have is mainly all the countries west of Euphrates to the Greek Sea. And this is not the place, but I think last time I was here 2 years ago in Inalco, I talked about earth and water, Abu Khak. It has a special resonance in this Iranian imaginary. It actually means something. It is not just a simple sort of parlance. There's a debate over if it's really Iranian or not, but certainly from, I think, the Avestan all the way to the recent time, this idea that a civilization, a nation, if we can use a nation in the modern term, is connected with boundaries with water and land, and both count. I make a very silly comparison. I think many of you may have seen some Iranians who are very nationalistic, but not about the land, but rather the naming of waters, such as the Persian Gulf and so on. And even when they make images, this water seems to be attached to the land. I think this psychologically represents this affinity with earth and water, Abu Khak, as is known in Persian. And here again, the boundaries that are given is west of Euphrates to Alexander, what is offered, which he obviously does not accept. This I have said many times, and I will mention in my last lecture, we can come all the way to the 10th century, where in the preface to the Book of Kings, but the prose, Abu Mansuri 960, it discusses this place, Iran, or Iran Sher, says it's from Oxus River to the Euphrates River. So be it Darius III in the 4th century BCE suggesting giving lands but not the Iranian part, or the Book of Kings, which is part of this repertoire of earlier historical tradition and narrative and imagery of the Iranians, again, what we see is it's from river to river to Euphrates. I think there's something there. It's just not a common usage. The idea of Iran to be existing in some form in not only ethnos but geographical conception can also be inferred, at least I think, from Strabo, who mentions the name Aryana, which we usually sort of think of as Aryana in Afghanistan in the east, is extended by him, he states, so to include parts of Persis, Media, Bactria, Sogdiana further. And for these nations, he says, speak nearly the same language. Antonio Panaino has tried to make sense of the passage as to its meaning. He suggests, I believe correctly, that rather than homoglossia, meaning that provincial citizens speak Persian, Median, Bactrian, and Sogdian languages were commonly understood, rather a variety of old Persian, what he calls a sort of lingua franca of the empire from the Achaemenid period, existed. He also narrowly suggests a political common connotation, although he makes sure that he does not cross Gerardo Nioli's suggestion that everything comes about in the 3rd century in his book, The Idea of Iran. But Panaino states what I think is in the right direction. He says, a sort of conservative declaration of belonging to a common and presumably higher ethno-religious heritage exists there. And I think by extension, a sense of land as well. I think one should think of Aryana or Arya with its geographical description in a serious ethno-cultural linguistic connotation. Now, having furnished some of the evidence from the period that I've discussed, and if I can have water, I would like to go to the important author and architect and scholar Gerardo Nioli, who in 1989 wrote a very important and well-received book, The Idea of Iran. His verdict in the book is as follows. The political, religious, and ethnic conception of Iran is a typical elaboration of the first half of the 3rd century AD or CE. It seems to have come into being all of a sudden. It just suddenly appeared in the 3rd century. As the backbone of the Sasanian propaganda, probably in the 20s of the 3rd century. So talking about Ardashir I, the founder. This was repeated by Nioli in the Encyclopedia Iranica under Iranian identity in the pre-Islamic period, where he actually changes his position a bit more, I think more acceptable. The idea of Iran as a religious, cultural, and ethnic reality goes back as far as the 6th century BCE. So he has now taken this further back. As a political idea, we first catch sight of it in the 20s of the 3rd century CE as an essential feature of Sasanian propaganda. It is this past that I have here tried to briefly survey and give some further evidence to. I am certainly not the first to question Nioli's thesis. The late Alireza Shapur Shahbazi had already responded to Gerardo Nioli's 3rd century idea of Iran thesis and raised reasons to which a large part went unnoticed. How one can assert that before the Sasanian Empire, the idea of Iran had already begun to take shape. I, unlike Newley, am unsure of the extent in which this sudden development took shape with Ardashir, the founder of the Sasanian Empire. Rather, I believe there must have been a pre-existing idea which found itself in the province of Fars in the pre-Sasanian period. And I think some clues as to what in Middle Persian it's called Eri, which I call it Iranianness. And by this I use a later Islamic sort of Perso-Arabic term, adab. Adab in the terms of manners, the way you do things, the way you eat, your gestures, your acting, your mores, values, and then later on what you think of the past and your heroes is part of this Eri, to be more, I think, explained, is quite, I think, instructive. Since Newley's important work, there has been much advances in our understanding of the history of the province of Fars, Persis, yeah, southwestern Iran, by Josef Wieshofer, Pier Francesco Callieri, Closan Musler's numismatic work, between the time of Alexander and the conquest of the Sasanians in the 3rd century AD. We now have, I think, a very well sort of sequence of the Frataraka kings. This is actually one of the Fratarakas here that appeared during the Seleucid rule. So these are a sub-governor, sub-ruler, however you want to call them. And I will talk about this in my next lecture, the Fratarakas. Beside them, we have a series of called kings of Persis. Which in Aramaic it says Malka, so they're kings, and that's why they're called the Persis kings after the Frataraka. And these Persis kings are quite interesting. In next lecture, you will see that their names, Daraz, and so on, create a huge and new narrative for the national history. But if we look at, again, onomastics and names, we find that these Malkas, these kings, have names that are either Achaemenid, so Dara, Ardakhshar, or Ardashir. I've modernized it to the 3rd century. Or those belonging to the Fratarakas, Vahshir or Vahshur, Vatfradad. Or Parthian ones, such as Pakur. Leaving Nambad aside, which is problematic, there is one name that appears for three kings of the province of Fars, Persis, from the first half of the 2nd century. So I am one century behind Newley, right? Or more. Namely, what is written as Manchir, who appear to be Parthian sub-kings as well. And they rule from probably 1 CE to 50 CE of the 2nd century. The last Manchir is Manchir III, or Manuchir, if you know the Persians or the parlance, appears in the second half of the 2nd century with the image that is reminiscent of Ardashir, the founder of the Sasanian dynasty, on his coins and reliefs. So here's Manchir, century earlier, and this is Ardashir at the Battle of Hormozgan, where he has defeated the last Parthian ruler, Ardavan. The Corymbius is not Corymbius exactly, but I need one because after this, rather than just having your hair fluffed, they put a sort of a turichimisha, they put a covering on it to sort of make this go up. But certainly, I think the headgear is similar to that of Ardashir, Manchir. More importantly, is the position of not so much Manchir in the Persis sort of line, but the namesake in the Iranian lore as recorded by the Middle Persian sources from the Sasanian to the post-Sasanian period. So from all of these names that I've discussed is the Manchir, Manuchir, Manuchir that I would like to pick out, and the three that appear in the Persis coinage. While the Shahnameh ensures the continuity of the Middle Persian tradition, there are still more details in the earlier text. We may begin with the shortest text, namely the Mah Farvardin Ruz Khordad, section 22, which provides the seminal, I think, importance in the Persianate tradition and one of the only times that Arash, the archer of the Aryas that we discussed in the Yashts, Tishdar Yash, is mentioned. And Professor Gurney, of course, has done the last translation of this. Ma farvardin ruz khordad manushcher od irishe shibag tir tig zamig az frasyag tur abas stad. And so one day, on the day of Khordad, the month of Farvardin, Manushcher, the namesake of Manchir, and Arash or Erash, the swift arrow took back the land from Frasyag, the Turanian. If one follows Persian mythology, it is clear that the famous battle between Iran and Turan took place between Manushcher and Afrasiab, where Arash, with his twinkling arrow vibrating, set the boundary in the east. Somewhere we have Persian sources giving multiple accounts. The best one that I like is that the arrow hits the Gozbon, a walnut tree in the east, and that is the boundary that is set. To expand the boundaries, of course. But in two of the best long books of the Zoroastrian tradition, the Bundaheshen, the Book of Primal Creation, and Dinkat, Acts of Religion, we find the importance of Manushcher for the Iranian lore and the idea of Iran. In the Bundaheshen, Manushcher is the grandson of Iraj, who was actually my father's name is Iraj, or was, the ruler of Iran, who was killed by his two brothers, as you see in this manuscript, namely Salm and Tuch, which is me, Turch. And as the Bundaheshen states, from Manush and his sister, so he's giving a much more longer here genealogy, Manushkhuarnar was born, and from Manushkhuarnar and his sister was born Manushcher, who slew Salm and Tuch, me again. He sought vengeance from Iraj. But in the Dinkat Book 3, we find that the most direct connection between Manushcher and now the Sasanians in Book 3, from the time of Yima Jam to Phaeton, the lineage is passed on to Manushcher. And then the Kianids and these who of Aridan, the well-born, which are the Sasanians. So this connection is already in Dinkat mentioned from Manushcher to the Sasanians. More than anyone in the Middle Persian literature, more than most, Manushcher is seen as the ruler of Iran. He's called Manushcher Iran Dahibet, the ruler of the Iranians, sovereign of Iran, and so on. I believe that the appearance of the three Manushchers, the ones that I showed the coinage, this is the third one, and that's the first one. There's another one. And you could see change in typology. I think it suggests a memory of the Iranian tradition, which has already existed before the Sasanians, where both, I think, Pirat and Kelenz, who call a Manushcher the progenitor of the Iranians. Let's see if I can find where I was. If Manushcher is the progenitor of the Iranians, and that he is connected to the Sasanians in Middle Persian literature as the one that we just saw, when was and from where was this tradition adopted by Ardashir I, the founder of the Sasanian dynasty? From where? And his family, who live in Persis. Here I would like to trace the connection via numismatics, as well as onomastics and textual evidence for Ardashir and his family, namely Sasan. I would like to look at the Indo-Parthian dynasty and its coinage in Sistan or Sakistan, so we're now moving from Fars to the east, which their rule, according to Joe Cripp and his chronology, began with Gundafaras I, around 20 CE, and the last ruler, who used to be called Ardamitra, which now, thanks to Alexander Nikitin, has given his full name, Farn Sasan, and As you can see, the legend reads Fan Sasan, son of Adur Sasan. So this Sasanian seems to be somewhere, certainly in Khorasan. I'm sorry, Sistan, grandson of Tirdad. So I have some Parthian naming here. Great grandson of Sanabar, king of kings. In some ways, this coin of the Indo-Parthians is significant as it has a very long and detailed mention of Fan Sasan's pedigree. Other Indo-Parthian coins do not have these long sort of genealogical explanations. And Nikitin suggests that it is because of the possible separatist tendencies of these local rulers in Sistan. And that's why we see this emphasis on the genealogy. What is also significant is the reverse coin of Farn Sasan, you see there, where we early on see this sort of fire altar, which very much matches the very first Sasanian ruler, Ardashir. There had been some discussions of which one came first. I think the verdict is that Farn Sasan is earlier, and this was perhaps made on this model. And you could see the very close similarity. This is just not a, let's do a fire altar. The Persian kings had fire altars. You see that, but there's no way close to this and in this manner. So it's just a borrowing, at least to me. Sistan is an important... It's important for its position in the Iranian lore and mythology. The founder of the Indo-Parthian dynasty, Gondapharus, around 20 CE, has been suggested to belong to the Surenid clans, who also brought into being in Sistan other traditions. Some suggest the Rustam narrative. The Bundahishan also states that there is, again, a connection between Sam and some of these local heroes and Sistan. Why Sistan is an important center can be gleaned again from another short Middle Persian text. I just played through these Middle Persian texts with the permission of Professor Azanush, who I'm sure has much to say why I'm picking so much out, but I think they're quite revealing in their details. The Abdi Otsahagi Hai Sistan, the wonders and worthiness of Sistan. And there are a few really important emphases here. That it says, then Feridun went to the Frazdan Lake. So this lake is important. He asked a favor from Ardavisur Anahita. So we got one Anahit and other gods who were placed in Sistan to rearrange Iran Shah, the empire of the Iranians, and the glory of the Kiyanis, these mythical sort of Avestan kings. The favor was obtained. And Manuchehr, not anybody else, but Manuchehr, and they praised the Iranians. Manuchehr again shows up amongst all the names that you have. It is significant that the deity invoked along with other gods who are, is not Urmaz here, but it is Anahita, what is known as the patron deity, of course, of the Sasanian dynasty or family. This is the latest book by Mania Saidi-Nejad, who has written a historiographical work on Anahit, but already since the time of Marie-Louis Chaumont has this discussion been on the etymology of what Ardavisur means. I know Jean Kellens has given his understanding, and I think has been reviewed somewhat critically by Professor Grenet, if I remember correctly, most of it accepting, but there were a few nonsense here and there. So you have the Ardavisur Anahita as the patron saint of the Sasanians, if I can use that, and we see Anahita being present somehow in Sistan as well. And that is Manuchehr. That is from Sistan, at least in this text is being mentioned, along this Lake Frazdan, where the glory of the Kiyanis, I'm just repeating this Middle Persian text that we just read, and the rearrangement of Iran Shah, this is what I mean, of the Empire of Iranians. Both Matthew Canepa and Carlo Ceretti, both of my colleagues now at UC Irvine, have suggested that Sistan, with its Parto-Sasanian temple of Kuhekhwaje, was to be the earliest Sasanian, i.e. Ardashir's attempt, a place, to control the Avestan tradition with a monumental focus, and that the important Yasht 19, this is the Kayon Yasht, the important exhibition of mythical history of these Iranians, is taking place in Sistan. Incidentally, if one looks at the archaeological reports vis-a-vis hydrology of ancient Afghanistan, East Iran, namely through the work of Mitch Allen and William Truesdale, and recently survey satellite imagery analysis by the United Nations Environmental Program, so I'm really going scientific, by Zoltan Vekredi and Remco Dust, it has been pointed out in many places, and I was just talking about this with Professor Ceretti again, Carlo, that its hydrology matches of what we find in the Yasht, but Professor Grenier had already mentioned this many moons ago. Specifically, the Zamyad Yasht, with its river systems, for example, Lake Kasaval, along with the Hatuman River, that's there where stands Mount Ushidau, surrounded by waters that run from the mountain, and is mentioned as such. And I have, sorry, so this is the Zamyad Yasht. So we're looking at this sort of the hydrology of this region. Here, Yasht 1966, which contains some strophes dedicated to the celebration of Helmand and some of its affluent rivers, such as Huastra. Where's Huastra? I can't even see anything from up here. No, it's not. Where's the Huastra? And so you'll see these names, rivers, Huvaspa, Fradata, Huaren Huvaiti, Ushtavaiti, Urva, Erezi, and Zarnumati, which match the late but early Persian geographical text called Tarikh-e Sistan, which you could find its evidence for it, where this lake Kayanse, Hamun-e Helmand, and also Ushada Mountain can be identified, as been suggested by many scholars, including Professor Grenier, but others as well, to be this Kuhekhwaje, the Mountain of Lords, which we will see, or have we seen it? No. So this location. The Western connection to Sistan and Zamyad Yasht had already been pointed out, as I mentioned, for chapter one of the Vidivdat by Professor Grenier, with its isoglosses, which he expertly connected to each land, archaeological, botanical, hydrological peculiarities that existed even in the life today in Afghanistan. Thus, in Yasht 1967 comes nine rivers, which formed the alluvial plain attributed to Lake Hamun. And I'm using Eric Pirat's latest translation, Les Orables, by Max Milo, published. So Hamun and Helmand and Sistan become an epicenter of Iranian tradition, as is remembered in the Avesta. Let's go back to the name of Sasan as it appears. The progenitor of Ardashir and his dynasty, Sasan, are important. And one should state that it is only with King Narseh, who rules from 293 to 303, and his Paikuli inscription that we find the direct connection between Ardavisuranahita, the river goddess, the Sasanians, and in the name of Urmaz and all the gods, and Anahita. So it's again, Urmaz is important, but Anahita is the other one important. But the dynastic deity and the Sasanians are also connected in this way, ever since the gods gave glory and rulership to the family of Sasan, and ever since His Majesty Ardashir, King of Kings, who was your grandfather, in the name of the gods, have made the whole realm. But also in his rock relief, it is suggested that here we're seeing Ardavisur Anahita providing the diadem of rulership to King Narseh. At least this is the dominant suggestion. Others have suggested that this is actually the wife of Narseh who has been returned to him after the disastrous war with the Romans. I'm almost done, so just please bear with me. Of course, we have to understand the position of Sasan, the Sasanians, the name, as is taken for the name of the dynasty. In terms of onomastics, it was Vladimir Lifshitz who first brought attention to an Astrakhan with the personal name of Sasan. And then we find these Sasan names in Sistan and in East Iran, Mir Sasan in Nisa, belonging to a large group of what he calls Parthian names, including Sasan Dad, Sasan Bokht, the name of which he calls Sasan being a deity that's not in the Avesta, but certainly was some sort of deity. And then we get names such as Surush Sasanak, Varahran Nag Sasan, earlier seen on a bulle by Mason and Pukchenkova in the 1950s, which I have not seen. I don't know if anyone has seen. He says that the name becomes prevalent in the 3rd century CE with the Sasanians. And pointing from the time of Ardashir, is Sasan Suren. Here we have the Surens again. Or Parthian clan from the inscription. Martin Schwartz has seen in Sasan something different, namely an ancient deity from the Mediterranean world. But it was Philippe Gignoux who provided the internal evidence for the function of Sasan and Rika Gisle, under Rika Gislin's identification of a seal that she published, based on the sigillographic evidence, which states as a protective deity. This is a magic seal. And this was published by Rika, and I don't think she's here, but I thank her for sending it to me. I said, Rika, please help. And she does, always. Where the seal reads, Vahram, did I do this right? Yes. Vahram, dochte dad borz mihran sasan, ham im sasan, im bay ot sasan pasban. So he is some sort of protector deity, apparently. Now, I know these seals show, and I think Professor Azarin showed one last time that had a bull-headed mace that she mentioned that it was Fereydoun in the previous one. I'm not sure if this one is a bull-headed mace. I see a little bit different in this. And this, I'm going to make a guess here, but again, based on your suggestion in another article, that the appearance of a hero striking a biped wolf can hearken to the story of perhaps, you have mentioned this, I think, of Ushidar, striking the demon. And the location is from probably Lake Hamun, where we talk about Kuh Khaje. Niuli believes this free-flowing waters of the Sistan were considered among the beneficial deeds of actually Manucheh again. And at the time of restoration, and this Ushidar is one of the Sushyans or the saviors that is supposed to come and strike this biped demon. Thus, there seems to have been a deity in eastern Iran, including Sistan, where Farn Sasan had been ruling from. Although we may think of Sistan a distance from Fars, that is from here to here, where Farn Sasan had been ruling from. Although, I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself. It seems to be a short, a long distance, but it is not. And it's not impassable. And not only roads of modern today make it simple, but I think the idea of being able to go east, west, and the south, rather than is clear. I just take a passage from, from the Vitae of Ardashir, the son of Babak, which clearly states that Ardashir was easily able to send forces and to go back to Kerman, this east-west, southeast-southwest corridor along the Persian Gulf. And that suggests mobility to me. All of this makes sense. That is the connection between Ardashir, the founder, family of Sasan, and Sistan. When we take into consideration a paper that was delivered by Marek Olbrecht, Marek Jan Olbrecht, At a conference that we organized in Vienna many moons ago, with Vesa Sarhosh, Elizabeth Pendleton, and Michael Alra, entitled The Parthian and Early Sasanian Empire, Adaptation and Expansion. In his paper, Ulbricht suggested that the old Parthian family of Suren, I think this is the third time I've mentioned the Suren, and Karen, along with the family of Sasan, were part of the Gondafrids of Indo-Parthia, the one that found Sasan as the last, who collaborated in overthrowing the younger line of the Parthians who were in charge in the 3rd century. I too have emphasized that with all the patronymics and associations with Dara and the Kianids in the late Sasanian Empire, and we'll see that in the second lecture, that Ardeshir was a relative upstart, not being really firmly established among the old Persian aristocracy, but fully Persianized in the time when his family lived in Iran. I think what we are seeing in this 2nd century of Common Era, and later with Ardeshir and the Sasanians in the 3rd century, is the confluence of two sets of memories and traditions. One of the Achaemenids, if it is Achaemenids, and I'll discuss that in the next lecture, Fars and the Achaemenids, and how we're faint through the Fratarakas and the Persis, the local Persis tradition, which harkens to an imperial past. The other is the Sistan tradition, which encapsulates Avestan tradition, namely the Yasht of the Avesta, what appears in the Helmand region, and the Zoroastrian lore of Lake Hamun, and the sacred cultic temple of Kuh Khaje, and the savior, which comes from the lake. These matters had gained synergy certainly by the 2nd century, if not later in the 1st century, in the province of Persis. I would furnish one last example of why I think the idea of Iran and Iran Shah, as I will discuss it, has its resonance in Sistan. Among all the local Persian histories that exist, from the earliest one, Tariq Qum, Tariq Bukhara, Farsnameh ibn Balkhi, and Tariq Tabaristan, it is only one local history in the early Persian historical tradition that actually discusses Shahr-e-Iran and mentions Iran. Iran is notably and dominantly mentioned in the earlier part of the Tariq of Sistan. It's not in any other local histories. And I think there is a reason for this and its absence in these other local histories, where again Manuchehr is picked and connected to this Shahr-e-Iran, the cities of Iran or the empire of Iran that is repeated. It is in this way that we can make sense of the knowledge at the court of the 3rd century Sasanian king, which based on the recent work of Ian Gardner, Jason Bedun, and Paul Dilley on the Chester Beiti Kefalaya Codex, that demonstrates that in the 3rd century, Prophet Mani had furnished knowledge at the court, where he mentions in this text, and again, thank Jason Bedun, who kindly supplied the text to me, the mention of Kei Khosro. So Kavi Khosrova of the Avesta already is known in the 3rd, 4th century. This is not a later Hunnic or Eastern, I think, attack that creates the earliest notions of it, if I can, because the Chester Beiti tells us. Not only they're mentioning Kei Khosro in a reworked fashion, but also Zoroaster. And so there is knowledge of what is already in the Yash, and I'm suggesting it comes from the East. So in conclusion, the idea of Iran was in existence, I think, already it's kerneling since the Avestan period and the Median and the Achaemenid tradition I mentioned. And then the influence of the Sistani tradition on Fars is great. And I think that avenue of thought created or had a main part to do in the construction of the history of Sistan and Iran. But for the Persian influence, please allow me to discuss that in the next lecture. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.